From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I believe the brigade is up to 8 KIA now and pretty close to 20 wounded. You might think we're dropping like flies. It's looking pretty bad as far as numbers go. But keep your head in this game. We will win this fight. They will calm down out there or we're going to kill them.
Off to war from rural Arkansas to Baghdad. We'll speak with the embedded filmmaking team, brothers Brent and Craig Renault. Then a new documentary examines the links between the oil industry and military invasions. It's called The Oil Factor, Behind the War on Terror.
Is it conceivable that the United States, that dominates the world with its technology, its economy, its military, its space programs, is it conceivable that such a power would let itself fall at the mercy of the outside world for an energy source indispensable to its existence? This is impossible.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Staff Sergeant Ivan Frederick was sentenced yesterday to 8 years in jail for his role in torturing detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison. The sentencing came one day after he pled guilty to 8 counts of abusing and humiliating Iraqi prisoners. Frederick admitted forcing detainees to masturbate and helping attach wires to a detainee with the intention of making him think he might be electrocuted. He also pled guilty to punching a detainee in the chest so hard that a medic was called. He's the highest ranking of 8 soldiers charged with abusing prisoners at Abu Ghraib. In addition, Wednesday, he testified that an interrogator from the private company CACI ordered him to use dogs to threaten prisoners. In Mosul, mortar shells were fired at the entourage of U.S.-backed Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi as he was leaving the northern city. Journalists reported hearing 5 explosions. Alawi was not harmed. When asked about the attack, Alawi suggested he was expecting to face an assassination attempt. He said, quote, "My visit to Mosul had been announced publicly, and I was surprised that this did not happen at the beginning of my visit, but only at the end." Meanwhile, a member of Alawi's National Accord Party was assassinated in Samarra on Wednesday. A new U.S. finance poll has found more Iraqis still feel their country is headed in the wrong direction and that Iraq's religious leaders would win elections if they were held today. The poll found leaders of Iraq's religious parties have emerged as the country's most popular politicians and would win the largest share of votes if an election were held today. Meanwhile, the U.S.-backed government of Alawi is losing serious ground. The Washington Post reports on the poll conducted by the International Republican Institute. The Post reports the Bush administration is hoping the interim president, a former CIA asset, Iyad Alawi, wins the election, but that appears unlikely faced with opposition from Iraq's religious leaders. Less than half the country even supports Alawi serving in the National Assembly. The poll found the most popular politician to be Abdelaziz Hakim, leader of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, a group the U.S. claims is funded by Iran. Iraqi support of the current U.S.-backed government is plummeting. In late summer, 62% of Iraqis said the new government was being effective. Today, the figure stands at just 43%. One U.S. official told the Washington Post, quote, "The picture it paints is that after all the blood and treasure we've spent, and despite the U.S.-led occupation's democracy efforts, we're in a position now that the moderates would not win if an election were held today." Middle East analyst Juan Cole is reporting a Baquba mosque leader was arrested by Iraqi police for allegedly urging on the resistance and funding it. The preacher, Sheikh Mohammed Ali Samari, regularly uses his Friday prayer sermons to call for rejection of U.S. presence in Iraq. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting that senior Bush administration officials are now admitting privately Iraq's resistance has significantly more fighters and far greater financial resources than was previously estimated. Agence France-Presse is reporting the Iraqi government has lost some $7 billion in oil money due to sabotage and lack of funding. Iraq's production of oil is so low, it's been forced to begin importing $200 million worth of oil every month. Meanwhile, in The Guardian of London, journalist Naomi Klein reports the cash-strapped Iraqi government was forced yesterday to pay $200 million in reparations to foreign countries and corporations stemming from Saddam Hussein's 1990 invasion of Kuwait. Since Hussein was toppled, the post-Saddam Iraqi government had paid out a total of $1.8 billion in reparations, and nearly 80% of that has gone to foreign corporations. According to Naomi Klein, millions will go to U.S. corporations who claim their business was somehow harmed, even if in the most indirect way, by the Kuwait invasion. Some of the corporations profiting include Texaco, Halliburton, Bechtel, Mobil, Shell, Nestle, Pepsi, Philip Morris, Sheraton Hotels, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Toys R Us. The former director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, admitted to an audience in Michigan that the invasion of Iraq was, quote, wrong. This, according to a report by the Michigan newspaper, the Herald Palladium. Tenet's comments came while speaking before the Economic Club of Southwestern Michigan. Senate Democrat Carl Levin Thursday issued a 46-page report charging one of the Pentagon's top officials, Douglas Feith, deceived Congress by asserting U.S. intelligence had definitively established ties between the government of Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Levin said as recently as January 2004, Feith was misrepresenting what the intelligence said. Levin called on the Armed Services Committee to take appropriate action against Feith. A new report by the Physicians for National Health Program has found nearly 1.7 million military veterans have no health insurance or access to government hospitals and clinics for veterans. The study reported the number of uninsured veterans jumped by 235,000 since 2000, and that veterans are losing their health insurance at a rate faster than the general population. The United Nations warned Thursday that northern Uganda is suffering the most neglected humanitarian crisis in the world. The head of the UN's humanitarian affairs estimated 20,000 children are caught up in a war and 1.6 million people have been displaced. Russia's lower house of parliament is expected to vote today on the ratification of the Kyoto Protocol. If it's approved, the International Treaty on Climate Change will go into force as a legally binding document. In Cuba, 78-year-old President Fidel Castro is recovering from a fall on Wednesday night, during which he fractured his knee and arm. Castro fell to the floor at a televised ceremony. In Washington, when the State Department spokesperson, Richard Boucher, was asked Thursday whether he wanted to wish Castro a speedy recovery, he replied, no. This is in a report in the Washington Post. And in Boston, a 21-year-old journalist student celebrating the Red Sox victory died Thursday after she was shot in the eye by a police officer with a so-called non-lethal projectile. Police shot these projectiles doused in pepper spray at a crowd of protesters who took to the street to celebrate the Red Sox victory over the New York Yankees. Frida Payne, Bring the Boys Home, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, 19 members of a U.S. Army Reserve platoon were placed under arrest for refusing to obey orders to go on what they considered a, quote, suicide mission. Stationed at Talil Air Base, south of Nasiriyah, members of the 343 Quartermaster Company were ordered to drive a fuel supply convoy up to Taji, north of Baghdad. The soldiers had previously only focused on local missions in safer parts of southern Iraq and had never driven through Baghdad, more than 200 miles away, where U.S. forces regularly come under fire. On average, U.S. soldiers were attacked 87 times a day in August. Over 1,100 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq since the war began. The platoon refused the order, considering their trucks to be extremely unsafe. They said the convoy tankers lacked bullet-resistant armor and were not able to travel faster than 40 miles per hour. Some of the supply trucks were in disrepair and prone to breakdown. And while the armed escort of Humvees and helicopters normally provided was not available, one of the soldiers later described the mission as a death sentence. After refusing the orders, the U.S. Army placed the men and women of the platoon under arrest. The place the soldiers refused to travel to, Taji, is north of Baghdad. That's the headquarters of members of the 39th Infantry Brigade of the Arkansas National Guard deployed in Iraq. On Saturday, the third installment of a documentary series following those National Guard soldiers will air on Discovery Times. It's called Off to War, From Rural Arkansas to Baghdad. The soldiers are stationed at Camp Cook in Taji. It's the first time since World War II that this many Arkansas National Guard soldiers have been deployed to a combat zone. Many of the soldiers have never traveled beyond the borders of Arkansas and now face an entire year away from home. Back in Arkansas, their families grow more fearful that these guardsmen, who work in sales, farming, and other non-military jobs, could become the targets of Iraqi insurgents bent upon attacking Americans. The soldiers arrived in Iraq in April of 2004. As the security situation in the country begins to deteriorate, Camp Cook is being mortared on a daily basis, and the Arkansas National Guard begun suffering casualties the first day they arrived in Iraq. Embedded with them are the filmmaker team, brothers Craig and Brent Renault. Our colleagues here at the Firehouse at Downtown Community Television, DCTV. In a moment, we will talk to them in our studio. But first, we go to an excerpt of Saturday's installment, Off to War.
I believe the brigade is up to 8 KIA now and pretty close to 20 wounded. You might think we're dropping like flies. It's looking pretty bad as far as numbers go. But keep your head in this game. We will win this fight. They will calm down out there or we're going to kill them. I think they think that we're going to run scared. Negative.
Except for we're not building a dam for a flood. We're filling the sandbags to put around our houses. These sandbags will stop, well, hopefully, it'll stop the shrapnel from going through your trailer and killing you while you're asleep.
I wish it could have been earlier, maybe saved a life or two.
Yeah, there's trailers over there that the shrapnel went all the way through, two whole trailers, so I don't think sandbags are going to help.
The mortars, no matter how good they are, if they land anywhere in here, they're going to get somebody.
Well, let me go ahead and put you this directive out. Body armor and Kevlar will be worn 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you're outside of that trailer, it will be on. Whatever it takes to keep you guys alive, I'm committed to do. If either one of our guys that died had this stuff on, they'd probably still be with us. Just for wearing something. Let's not lose any more. Wear it. It's not an option. All hell is broken loose, and it's right outside that gate. Getting ready to fit up and go out on a mission today. What we're supposed to be doing It's security and stability operations, which we basically have just tossed that out the window. There's no security here, and there is no stability here. You know, it's basically a full-fledged, very hot combat zone. All right, guys, let's go ahead and move on out. Another wonderful day.
Situation is vehicle pulled up to a U.S. checkpoint. Military age male dismounted from the van, produced what appeared to be a weapon. That weapon turned out to be a toy gun, cigarette lighter. Gunner from the Diamond Element opened fire with 50 caliber fire. Break.
The 50 cal, you don't get shot anywhere with a 50 cal and not be seriously wounded.
The ensuing fire resulted in 3 Iraqis killed and 7 seriously wounded.
The people are going to be pissed off that we shot a bunch of innocent people.
Any children or women?
I think there was a woman in the rear vehicle who went into labor.
I think this stuff is crazy, man. I really don't want to be here.
Unfortunate, but they got to know that we're serious about this. We're getting our people killed, and somebody wants to jump out with a toy pistol and start brandishing it like he's a big boy. He's going to get treated like a big boy. Lock and load, gentlemen. Okay, let the good times roll. Every time we leave this gate in this truck, it's a terrifying experience. Okay, Jones, today we're going to Psalms 4. But know that the Lord has set apart for himself him who is godly. The Lord will hear when I call to him. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. It's so strange being here. You know, I've always taught, you know, always heard about the Holy Land. This is not what I expect. It doesn't feel very holy. The Garden of Eden was in Iraq. I can promise you, this is no Garden of Eden. Where we're at right now is extremely, extremely hostile.
Yeah, it's also comforting to know none of this stuff's even on a map.
I think this is part of Sadr City. Not being able to read a single sign that's out here is also frustrating. We don't know one lick of Arabic. I don't know if they're advertising Taco Bell or if they're advertising that, hey, you know, kill all the Americans you can see. And I know we were told that 98% of the people are glad to see us here. I'm to the point right now where I think 98% of the people don't want us here. Now for the checking of vehicles. We won't stay here very long. We'll keep moving because we don't want to set up any one place very long, because all that does is just give them a chance to call ahead and set up an ambush for us.
Well, there's a compartment of some kind, but it's welded. You want to look, sir, or no?
That's all right. Which is
all right.
Shukran.
Hello.
I'm not into going out and meeting the people, you know, pressing the flesh, you know, trying to help them out and see what their needs are. They haven't given me time to see what their needs are because they won't quit attacking me long enough for me to find out what their needs are. I really wish we'd have trained more for combat operations. Train for the worst and expect the best. Well, we trained for the best and the worst happened.
An excerpt of the documentary Off to War from Rural Arkansas to Baghdad. We'll speak with the filmmakers, Brent and Craig Renault, when we come back from our break.
Come on, come on.
Burning Spear, No More War, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report, broadcasting on more than 290 community radio, Pacifica stations, NPR stations, public access TV, PBS stations, and both satellite networks on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, as well as 9410 Link TV, which is also on DirecTV, Channel 375. This is Democracy Now!, and we are joined by the filmmakers who are doing the six-part series for Discovery Times called Off to War from Rural Arkansas to Baghdad, Brent and Craig Renaud. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's pretty astounding footage, very honest, the soldiers talking about what they're going through now. In light of this latest news from Iraq of the unit that has said no, they wouldn't go to Taji, which is where the unit you've been covering is,
right,
that they wouldn't go to refuel them. Now, the top officer there has been relieved of her duty. Had this ever happened in your unit?
Well, we arrived in Baghdad with a National Guard unit, with the Arkansas National Guard, in these same sort of unarmored vehicles. Right away in April, which was one of the bloodiest months of the war, when we arrived, there were, right off the battle, a lot of injuries and deaths, particularly with Echo Troop, who you just saw on the clip. Within that group, there were a number of guys who refused to go out on missions almost immediately after they had seen their friends and their fellow soldiers die right in front of them. Fortunately for them, Sergeant Short, who you see in the clip, the one talking in the Humvee, handled it internally, gave them time off, allowed them to get it together and to get back on the job. But I would say right off the bat, I witnessed about three to four guys who were just saying it's too dangerous to go out there. We're dropping like flies, as you also heard it in the clip. And this is pretty widespread sentiment.
Has anyone who refused, who then ultimately did go out, get killed or injured?
No, not that I'm aware of. The specific guys that Brent's referring to are all back out on missions, and a couple of them are actually in the vehicles that you see there in the clip, and so they have gone back out, and none of them have died.
Why are they allowing you to film this? I mean, the soldiers are making some pretty damning comments about what they are being forced to do to the Iraqis, about alienating the Iraqis.
Well, we Brent and I both grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, so we're from Arkansas. When we first found out that this brigade was going to Arkansas, we went to the National Guard, the 39th Brigade in Arkansas, and basically said, we really want to do this film. This is a sort of a hometown story for us because this is, you know, this is the largest brigade since World War II that's going into Iraq, and we wanted to cover the story. So our promise to them was that we would not use any voiceover narration and no music in the body of the show, and we've kept that promise, and that's how we've approached this film. We allow the soldiers to speak for themselves, and they've spoken very candidly as we've gone through the documentary. Mm.
And some things, like the issue of the armored vehicles, the National Guard themselves have complained about these sorts of things. They would like to bring it to the public's attention to understand that they are not as well equipped as the regular Army is.
How does it work? I mean, explain that. I think it's something new to the American public when these National Guardsmen are saying, we're not going to go because we don't have the armored vehicles. What do they mean?
Well, the way it works is that the units, when they go over to Iraq, bring their own vehicles from their home state. A lot of them, most of them, were never in combat. They were doing things like, you know, helping people after floods, cleaning up after tornadoes. They didn't have combat-ready vehicles. But since every unit brought their vehicles with them into Iraq, at least initially, that's the vehicles that they had to do their missions with. And the regular Army, by and large, took their vehicles back to the United States with them.
The documentary airs when?
It airs Saturday night, tomorrow night, October 23rd at 10 p.m. Eastern Time.
And Discovery Times is also going to air the first two before it, parts one and two.
That's correct.
And then you're doing four, five, and six. Final question. One of the officers saying, we've managed to do almost everything we did not want to do. Repeat that sequence. What did they do?
I believe you're referring to Lieutenant Mason. They came into a mission where they had to tear down a fence where they were being shot at. Their convoys were being shot at from behind a fence. And so the lieutenant in this unit had to go out and basically inform a farmer that they were tearing his fence down. And he said there were three things that he hoped not to do that day. One of those things being upsetting Iraqis, and he said that that was one thing that they definitely did. Another thing was disrupting their water supply for their house. That was broken as well. And so that, you know, it's one of those missions that, you'll see in the documentary that, presents a challenge for these soldiers because they're going out and having to do these type of missions on a daily basis.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us watching on tomorrow night in on Discovery Times.
Thank you.
As we turn now to a documentary, a new documentary that examines the link between the oil industry and military invasions. It's called The Oil Factor Behind the War on Terror. And it is a documentary that... Well, it's been just over 3 years since the Bush administration began its large-scale bombing of Afghanistan, kicking off the so-called War on Terror, Osama bin Laden remaining at large. Tens of thousands of innocent civilians have been killed in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And so we felt it was critical to look at what many feel is the key factor behind it. Again, we bring you The Oil Factor Behind the War on Terror, produced by Gerard Ungerman and Audrey Brohey of Free Will Productions.
During the war, the Americans had a group of targets that they called high-value targets, and these were the Iraqi leaders, and they were bombing them in the cities. Now, the problem with this is that you've got thousands of kilos of weapons going into civilian areas. They took 50 shots at the Iraqi leadership, and they did not hit a single one. Well, in this 0-for-50 shooting at the Iraqi leaders, they're killing many, many civilians.
We're facing a problem because we have to receive many, many injured patients from the bomb. So it's a big job for five doctors in this hospital to receiving all injured patients in an area like this. At that time, the refrigerator of the hospital was filled with bodies, and the garden was the only place to keep these bodies.
After a brief and easy campaign, George Bush lands on the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln off the coast of San Diego, California.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001. America is grateful for a job well done.
Now, George Bush said that this was the most humane war ever fought, but civilians still died, and their deaths were not humane.
After hearing so much from Washington about how dangerous Saddam Hussein was, the total lack of resistance of the Iraqi military in and around Baghdad comes as a real surprise.
The resistance that we had wasn't very high at all. The only major threat that we had was the guerrilla warfare, and at times that wasn't much at all. Some traffic accidents, we had one Hummer roll over into a ditch at night.
Andrew
but that's
Schlappak,
basically the only
Iraq
real threat we had going into Iraq.
The information that was being put out
Lieutenant
about the danger
Colonel
that
Karen
Saddam
Kukowski
Hussein posed to the United States or United States interests was being grossly exaggerated. Sanctions had weakened Saddam Hussein. The long war with Iran, he'd never really recovered from that war. And frankly, he had been bombed by us with the enforcement of the no-fly zones for a dozen years, basically eliminating any possibility that he would be able to reconstitute his military.
The fundamental problem is that the central justification for going to war,
namely
that Iraq possesses, I emphasize the word possesses, weapons of mass destruction, which pose a grave danger to the United States as of now, obviously has turned out not to have been true. And that's a very serious problem. It damages American global credibility.
The political perspective that Saddam Hussein must go was not based on intelligence. It was formulated and developed and articulated very publicly during the Clinton administration years, and even somewhat during Bush 1, the predecessor to Bill Clinton. It was articulated through various organizations like the Project for New American Century, American Enterprise Institute, and others, who built their case that Saddam Hussein needed to go.
Instrumental in planning the removal of Saddam Hussein is the Project for the New American Century. Based in Washington, D.C., this think tank includes such members as Vice President Dick Cheney, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Defense Advisor Paul Wolfowitz, and Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Politically close to the Israeli Likud Party, the group openly advocates the cause of American leadership, the need to increase defense spending significantly, challenging regimes hostile to our interests and values, extending an international order friendly to our security, our prosperity, and our principles. While traditional American conservatives are more focused on taking care of problems at home, these self-proclaimed neoconservatives focus on promoting U.S. economic and military domination over the world.
I think the American public very quickly came to the conclusion after 9/11, not that Iraq was simply or somehow involved in 9/11, but they quickly came to the same conclusion that President Bush did, which was that if you thought through the full ramifications of 9/11, that is a state that harbored terrorists, a state that harbored terrorists who wanted weapons of mass destruction to use, and a state that was potentially, you know, producing weapons of mass or had produced weapons of mass destruction, the American public very quickly joined the president in his judgment that Iraq was as much a part of the problem after 9/11 as other states like Afghanistan.
I got a clear sense that what we were doing in the Pentagon, or what the neoconservative group was doing in the Pentagon as far as Middle East policy, was to not just fabricate falsehoods for the Defense Department, but to push that into the mainstream of American media.
Seeking any valid or fabricated evidence against Saddam Hussein, the Bush administration allies with an internationally wanted felon, the self-proclaimed Iraqi opposition leader Ahmed Chalabi.
Ahmed Chalabi has been living in Jordan. He ran away from this country on the 11th of August, 1989. He was the chairman of a bank, the Petra Bank, and he was accused of embezzlement. He has been condemned in absentia by a military court in Jordan for 22 years of prison, and he's responsible of over $1 billion of losses. I mean, this is what the court has said.
The main thing that happened was the influence of Ahmed Chalabi. In the office that I was at, I saw Ahmed Chalabi. He would come in to visit Bill Lutie. There was a military officer working in the Office of Special Plans whose job was described to me as the Ahmed Chalabi's handler. He would set up meetings downtown. They traveled to London to meet with members of the INC. Ahmed was a key source of a lot of these stories, that Saddam Hussein had vast quantities of undetermined weapons of mass destruction that he was going to either use directly against U.S. interest or give to terrorists who would do the same thing.
In June of 2004, accused this time of counterfeiting Iraqi money, Ahmed Chalabi runs again from justice. He flees from Iraq, where he had been appointed by the Bush administration to the so-called Iraqi Governing Council. For President Bush, this comes as the latest embarrassment surrounding the war in Iraq. In April of 2004, State Secretary Colin Powell himself publicly admits that had he known that Iraq didn't really pose a threat to peace, he wouldn't have supported the war. He blames the CIA, headed by George Tenet, for providing faulty intelligence, but he quickly adds that President Bush was right in his decision to remove what he calls a terrible despotic leader. John Negroponte was appointed U.S. ambassador to the UN by President Bush in 2001, and as such became the U.S. salesman of the war on Iraq at the United Nations. In the 1980s, while John Negroponte was ambassador to Honduras, the CIA was involved in covert operations in Central America, including the training of local death squads responsible for the disappearance of many Central American leftist opponents. In June of 2004, Negroponte is appointed U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Given the Bush administration's apparent concern for dictatorship in Iraq, John Negroponte's appointment comes as a surprising choice.
We're not too worried about dictators as long as they're on our side, do what we tell them. Democracy is not the reason we went in there. The main reason is geostrategic regional dominance, which is the one that relates to energy supplies. Another reason for this invasion occupation at the time that we did it had to do with the pressure to lift sanctions. There was a huge pressure building to lift sanctions on Iraq. Had sanctions been lifted or partially lifted, Iraq could have been filled with Europeans, Russians, Chinese, Japanese, all kinds of folks, no Americans or British folk, but we and the UK had been bombing Iraq for 12 years. Had sanctions been lifted with Saddam Hussein still in charge, we would have gotten no contracts and no opportunities to invest in Iraq. But furthermore, we would have lost the ability to attack Iraq at any time because Iraq would have been filled with foreigners. And then the other aspect to me is a smaller one, but it has to do with Saddam Hussein's decision in November of 2000 to switch to the euro for all of his oil for food exports. He had been on the dollar for decades, and he decided to switch to the euro. Had he gone into full production of his oil capability, and had he continued to trade oil on the euro and not the dollar, this would have actually had a financial impact on the United States in that central banks around the world would not, they would be more favorable towards the euro and less to the dollar.
The idea that the United States needed to go to war with Iraq over the issue of oil, I think, is just wrong-headed. So there was no push, you know, to get more oil by getting rid of Saddam. The truth is we had plenty of oil in the world and the supplies were enough.
In June 2004, just one day's worth of oil consumption would represent a line of barrels long enough to encircle the earth. With almost half used for fuel and the other half used for plastics and chemicals, oil is indispensable in every single aspect of our modern everyday lives. The world population has been able to increase over the course of one century from about 1.5 billion to 6.5 billion only because oil has allowed for more food to be grown and distributed than ever before.
World food production is so dependent upon hydrocarbon energy. All commercial fertilizers are made out of natural gas, which produces ammonia. All pesticides are made out of oil. Now with agribusiness, you drive an oil-powered machine to plow, you drive an oil-powered machine to plant, then you fertilize it with natural gas, then you irrigate it with water that's pumped by electric pumps where the electricity comes from burning natural gas or oil in most cases. Then you spray it with oil pesticides. Then you harvest it with an oil-powered vehicle. And you the bottom line is that we eat 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food consumed on the planet.
All around the world, oil consumption is exploding. New gigantic markets, such as those in India and China, have opened up to modern consumerism and have driven the global need for oil through the roof.
China, with its red-hot economy, just passed Japan as the second largest importer of oil on the planet. China's economy has had a 10% growth rate. It's on fire. The Chinese people are demanding more computers, automobiles. Chinese auto sales up 100% in 1 year. GM sales in China up 300% in 1 year. That's what keeps the American economy going.
La superpuissance.
The United States, the only superpower, uses 20 million barrels of oil every day, and it is estimated that it will need 25 million barrels per day around 2020. While its own reserves are dwindling, the U.S. only produces 5 to 6 million barrels per day and imports almost three-quarters of the oil it needs.
Satellite imaging applied to oil exploration has confirmed a stark reality. With increasing consumption and diminishing reserves, the world is rapidly running out of oil. At the current rate of production, the West will be first to hit the zero mark by 2010. At this point, both the United States and Europe will depend entirely on outside sources for their oil. Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, while self-sufficient today, are next and due to run out by 2013. With its exploding oil consumption, Asia will run dry in 2018. The reality, however, is that major conflicts are likely to erupt before any of these players actually runs out of oil.
An excerpt of The Oil Factor. We'll be back with it in a minute.
Voices on the radio tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for. The generals want to hear the end game. The allies want to prove the plan. But the oil men in the White House, they just don't give a damn. 'Cause it's all about the price.
Billy Bragg, The Price of Oil, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. As we resume with the documentary that is produced by Gerard Ungerman and Audrey Brohey, narrated by Ed Asner, called The Oil Factor, Behind the War on Terror.
A year and a half after the start of George Bush's controversial war on Iraq, the Iraqi population has grown increasingly hostile to its U.S. occupants. Sporadic violence has given way to organized resistance. Sabotage of pipelines has disrupted the flow of Iraqi oil. As a result, the price of oil on the international market has been driven to record highs. The seeds of chaos, however, were planted at the very time of the U.S. invasion, when GIs did nothing to stop hordes of looters from destroying Iraqi institutions.
As regards with the looting, when we were watching the looters, it's very interesting to see because they were grabbing anything and everything they could. They were grabbing doors, screws from doors, air conditioners, chairs, couches, anything that they can get their hands on, they took.
Sure.
The looters, they, you know, after the war, they started coming in with weapons. So it was a fight, you know, a crossfire between us. U.S. Army went in this area. We were able to talk to them, to the commander, to find, you know, to give us protection.
One of the things that's interesting in the focus of what the troops did when they invaded is they immediately seized the oil fields. But the focus on seizing the oil fields right away seemed to distract the forces from seizing other very important sites, for instance, securing the nuclear facilities.
While the U.S. military quickly secures Iraqi oil assets, the well-known Al-Tuwaitha Nuclear Research Center, some 15 miles south of Baghdad, is left totally unattended. As a result, local villagers make off with radioactive barrels they empty on the ground and recycle for storing food and water. Made aware of it, the U.S. authority fails to take proper action to protect the civilian population. Greenpeace steps in and, after surveying the entire area, offers the villagers a brand new replacement barrel for every contaminated barrel returned. The dangerous containers are quickly recovered and evacuated.
The focus on seizing the oil field forgot many, many other sites that in reality pose a much greater threat of terrorism, which was supposedly what this was about.
But in Iraq, radiation comes in other forms as well. Like during the 1991 Gulf War and the war in Kosovo, depleted uranium rounds were used again by the U.S. military, this time including the center of Baghdad. They lie around for anyone to see and touch. A Geiger counter will give a reading of between 5 and 15 pulses per minute in a typical environment. This depleted uranium round will trigger 10,000 pulses in about 40 seconds. This type of ammunition is radioactive because it is made of nuclear waste referred to as uranium-238 or depleted uranium. This material is left over from the processing of uranium-234 used for atomic bombs and uranium-235 used in nuclear power plants. Long considered toxic garbage, it found an extremely controversial application in the making of cheap, high-perforation shells. Uranium-238 remains radioactive for 4.5 billion years, and its toxicity reveals itself as soon as particles are inhaled or ingested. Cancer and birth defects are the most common side effects.
United States military forces used 320 tons of depleted uranium in the first Gulf War in 1991. The difference between the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War is very significant, and that is that in this second war, we've seen a lot more depleted uranium use in populated areas, in urban centers. American planes, A-10 Warthog planes that used DU rounds, the 30-millimeter DU rounds, fired at targets in cities.
These particular rounds were found inside the compound of one of Saddam Hussein's palaces in Baghdad. This compound is now guarded by American soldiers who are totally unaware of the contamination. Ironically, this particular palace was chosen by U.S. authorities to house their so-called Coalition Provisional Authority. As its boss, the White House appointed the former managing director of consulting firm Henry Kissinger and Associates, Mr. Paul Bremer.
The other key task of the coalition is to help build the democratic institutions to safeguard Iraq's newfound freedom. We want to ensure that the governing council, which emerges, is truly representative of all Iraqis, Shia and Sunni, men and women, Kurds and Arabs, secular and religious, tribal and urban. Democracy is on the move in Iraq.
Free elections would mean, whether in Iraq or any other Arab country, that Islamists will take power. because they are the majority. And in particularly in Iraq, it will most definitely be Shiite who will win because they represent 60% of the population.
نحن لم نرحب بالاحتلال.
We didn't welcome the invasion.
لأن رأينا كان هو أن لا تقع الحرب.
Because our viewpoint was that war must not occur.
وتكون مسؤولية التغيير مسؤولية الشعب العراقي.
And the responsibility of changing had been on the authority of the Iraqi people.
The Shiite majority, of course, would play a role in any democratic government. I suppose they decided to improve relations with Iran. As in fact the countries of the region have been trying to do over strong U.S. objections for years. Will the U.S. tolerate that?
Irani, علاقات تاريخية.
The relationship between the Iraqi people and the Iranian people is historical relations.
وبالتالي في العلاقات نسعى لأن تكون وطيدة وجيدة مع إيران.
So we strive to the relation to be good, to be brotherhood with Iran and with other countries.
Since 1979, when the U.S. Embassy personnel in Tehran were taken hostage by the Islamic Revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini, the U.S. government has kept Iran in its gun sight. The Americans' hatred for the Shia regime of Tehran grew even stronger when the Iranians became the sponsors of the Hezbollah, a violent Lebanon-based militant group responsible for many attacks on Israel since the 1980s. Free elections today in Iraq would mean the immediate victory of a potentially pro-Iranian Shia majority, something that Washington and Israel would never tolerate. Instead, the U.S.-led coalition provisional authority appointed a council of so-called Iraqi representatives.
أساساً أنا هاي الحكومة
جديدة
ما عندي
علم. لا تتوقعي رح تمثل الشعب الإيراني؟
رح تمثل
الأمريكان ما رح
تمثل
الشعب الإيراني.
نريد ابن العراق اللي كان عايش تحت المطرقة الصدامية، العذاب اللي شعر به العراق هنا عاش به، أما اللي كان عايش في رفاه وديمقراطية وجو حرية هذا ما. إحنا نريد ابن البلد يمثل البلد.
The council, I don't know who are they, but I don't think it is representing a broad of the Iraqi people.
The discrepancy between what the Iraqis want for their country and how Washington sees freedom and democracy is again illustrated by the appointment at the Iraqi Governing Council of such a corrupt individual as Ahmed Chalabi. Installing officials more loyal to money than to Iraq seems to be Washington's first step in opening up opportunities for U.S. corporations.
American corporations stand to win a huge amount of money in the current reconstruction process in Iraq, and many of those people are and corporations have very close ties to the administration. Many contracts so far were given without any sort of bidding process that was done.
And so you've got U.S. companies like MCI in line to run the telephone system. As I said, you've got a company like DynCorp that's helping them redo their justice system. You've got companies like Apt Associates, a U.S. consultant working on educational issues. You've already got American companies writing the textbooks in Iraq. You've got essentially a privatized occupation where Paul Bremer, the head of the Provisional Authority, a U.S. government appointee, is making all the decisions.
On the question of privatization, there's no reason at all why the service sector as well cannot be brought up and become a source of economic activity and therefore in the end also of revenues. But realistically, over the next 18 months, we are looking more or less at revenues from the oil sector.
What we've seen was a very quiet plan to privatize Iraq's oil. This is not really surprising from an administration that is run by former oil executives.
The first companies that were allowed to buy Iraqi oil post-occupation included Chevron, Condoleezza Rice's former company. She was a board member. They named a tanker after her.
Just recently, the president has decided to take more direct control over the reconstruction of Iraq by having Condoleezza Rice create a National Security Council entity that will allow her to sort of manage the reconstruction from the NSC.
In terms of refurbishing the existing oil production facilities and potentially bringing on new fields online, I imagine that a number of those contracts will go to American firms.
Halliburton is a multi-billion dollar American corporation specializing in building U.S. military bases and oil infrastructures worldwide. In May of 2004, Halliburton has awarded the contracts to refurbish Iraq's oil infrastructures, including wells, pipelines, and refineries.
I mean, how does it look to the rest of the world when the first big contract for rebuilding Iraq goes to Halliburton, Cheney's ex-company? He is still getting money from that firm. He's getting $150,000 to $200,000 a year in deferred compensation. He still owns stock options that he can exercise when he chooses. So he still has financial ties to this company, even as it is the biggest company profiting not only in Iraq, but from the whole war on terrorism, because they're running the bases in Afghanistan, in Uzbekistan. They built the prison at Guantanamo, where they're putting the suspects incommunicado and so forth. The second big contract goes to Bechtel, which George Shultz and other major Republican figures are a part of.
In our contract with USAID is actually quite broad. We have responsibilities for infrastructure reconstruction in seven different sectors. First of all, the port of Umqasar. The second sector is roads, bridges, and railroads. The third area is the buildings and facilities, and this primarily are schools, medical facilities like clinics, and some ministerial buildings. The next sector is power. Another sector is water and wastewater, including irrigation. The final sector is aviation. Oh, and excuse me, one area I forgot to mention, one sector, was the communications.
American defense contractors made a fortune selling to the U.S. military the weapons and the bombs that destroyed Iraq. Now Bechtel, Halliburton, and the many other American contractors will make a fortune off contracts to rebuild Iraq's infrastructures. Regardless if the work is really done or not, the Iraqis will eventually be forced to pay for it with their oil revenues. In the meantime, not only did U.S. taxpayers pay for the war, but they will also have to front the money for the reconstruction as well.
The Oil Factor, Behind the War on Terror, narrated by Ed Asner, produced by Gerard Ungerman and Aubrey Brohi of Freewheel Productions. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.